Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. A little over a month into winter retreat. It's a very precious time, precious opportunity. So recognizing that we all come together, we'll all be separating again at some point. Come together for a period of time, and then at the end of that period, people go their separate ways. And so to take the opportunity and cherish the opportunity, be grateful, thankful to have this opportunity to practice. During a time of retreat in the monastery, we're studying the Satipatthana. This is trying to become contemplatives. And developing reflective minds, learning how to use the Dhamma teaching in order to contemplate and reflect and consider this body and mind, five aggregates, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, six sense bases, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Learning how to develop the contemplations of the body, feelings, mind, mental qualities, dhammas. There's all sorts of skillful means the Buddha has given us, a vast array of skillful means, teachings. There's not just one hard and fast set way. Although all of the teachings, you can say, are subsumed under the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. Those are the elephant's footprint that all the other teachings and the suttas and the canon are fit into. But different contemplations, different skillful means. Upaya, that's a skillful means. According to our temperament, our proclivities, habits, tendencies. So it's good to develop a long enduring mind. It's good to remember these things don't happen quickly. That's why we call it practice. That's why we call it cultivation. It takes time. It can take a long time. Depending on our parami, our spiritual perfections, virtues that we have built up from this life, possibly past lives as well. So it's good to remember to try to practice and contemplate in a way that's sustainable in order to become contemplatives, those who practice as life. Our life is our practice. It also can seem, noble silence, living in the monastery, same routine day in and day out. It's a whole array of mental states, emotions, moods, aramana might be arising. It might feel lonely, sad, inspired, full of faith, completely skeptical and no faith. One might have a very scattered mind, or one might be attaining states of concentration, samadhi. And then the next day, one isn't able to get back to that state of concentration. One feels sad. It changed. Or one feels anxious. That'll change. One feels completely elated. That'll change. One feels completely dejected and hopeless. That'll change. It's conditioned. It arose, so it'll change. Learning how to contemplate in these ways, using reflections like the reflection on impermanence, where we chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, a teaching on not self. So in the meditation, there might be ways defining ourselves. So I know for me, just sometimes the mind can get in a rut where it'll remember every time I was criticized by somebody. Think, woe is me, or defining myself based on some criticism from the past. It could even be from childhood or 20 years ago. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Mind will pick it up and run with it. Yeah. I am that way. You know, that other person criticized me. That shows that I am that way. So then, but then the contemplative mind kicking in and saying, well, who is that way? What is that way? Is form who I am? Is feeling who I am? Is a combination of form and feeling who I am? Is the mental formation who I am? How am I defining myself here? And did that person have a pure perception of who I am? Or were they speaking from bias? And how were all these other sankhara, mental formations at the time, playing into it? Or was it a teacher, a wise person, criticizing? And the Dhammapada says it's better to be criticized by a wise person than praised by a fool. So these various teachings can come up in the mind and you use them for contemplation. Also, something that can happen in the monastery, usually for newer people, but it can happen for everybody, is defilements can come up. It seems like they get stronger. Like a lot of people will say, like, before they started meditating, they didn't have that much defilement, and then they started meditating, and they had more defilement after they started meditating. More anger, more irritation, more greed, more lust, more delusion. But those things were always there, but especially in the West and in America, the American dream, to be able to pursue and get what you want when you want it, that is something that masks and hides defilements. So when we take on the precepts, especially something like the 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 227 precepts, this limits us in many ways, limits our actions, or not able to follow and play out those desire systems which we've been following for so many years. So, of course, those things are going to be highlighted, those things that were always there. So it's a learning experience. But it can be quite difficult, because it's new, so that sense of limiting oneself. It is normal to feel irritated, angry, exhausted, lonely at first. So we have to develop a long, enduring mind and be able to stick with it. If we have enough clarity, enough inherent wisdom to see the truth of the Buddha's teachings, then we'll end up sticking with it. But I've heard more than one senior monk say that having all this faith starting out and just full of faith, full of zeal, and then a few years down the road sitting in the kuti, just cursing the Buddha. Buddha pulled me in, and now it's like the long slog, the long haul, and now I have to do all this work to train myself. I can't quit, though. It's all, I see the truth of it, but it's a lot of work and a lot of it's heavy. It's something new, something we haven't done before. Or we could say it's heavy because we're still carrying it. The burden is heavy because we're still not able to let it go. But it's good to have these time of retreat. Hopefully we can create a container where the mind does start to enter into states of calm, and the thoughts and verbal formations do start to calm down. It's one of the reasons we create the container of noble silence, speaking only when necessary. It's very difficult to get that internal verbal formation to quiet down if we're still talking. So we limit the talking, we talk less, we try to internalize that. So the mind can quiet down a bit and the fog can start to clear. You can liken this to the beginning of the winter retreat is like setting sail on a journey, setting out on a ship into the unknown, ready to chart unknown waters, face the unknown, face the defilements, something we haven't done before, something new. Don't know what to expect. And it's going to be a long journey, and so we set out. We set sail. And now, a little over a month into that journey, this will be a 3-month journey, a little over a month into that journey, if the mind has started to quiet down a bit, then we can liken that to we're just surrounded by ocean, we're out in the middle of the ocean. You can imagine the water is calm. The swells and little wavelets of water lapping up against the side of the ship. Sun is out. It's comfortable. Good weather, the boat is just gliding along. There's a light breeze. It's important to have these rest periods as well. The journey isn't sustainable if it's just lashing rain and storm and thunder the whole time. So you're not gonna get to your destination that way. So the water is calm, the sun is out. The water is cool but not cold. You take a break, you don't have to be steering the ship, you just rest. Dolphins swimming around the ship, and you can jump in the water, swim, float in the water, the cool water, the sun on your face. And things are just quiet. There's no dangers, there's no sharks around, so the dolphins are there to protect you. So the mind can be peaceful. And perhaps there will be a time when there's a storm you have to face in the future, but for now, you can just rest, floating in that cool water. So it's important to have that in the meditation as well. Times of rest, times when it's enjoyable. If it's always a struggle, it's not sustainable. But then there is a sense of effort that comes back in. So, still needing to attend to the meditation object. But these kind of rest periods allow us to gather our energy for the inevitable storms, the waves that are going to come up during this journey. Also, part of developing a contemplative mind and using the Satipatthana, there's this phrase, abandoning greed and distress with reference to the world. A lot of it is just not believing the moods. Also not pushing them away with aversion, but just a sober recollection that they'll change. They're not stable or permanent. But that recollection, we don't bring that up in order to make them change or make them go away. It's like last year, someone came to the monastery one day and they were speaking with Lungpa and said, I contemplated impermanence and nothing happened. What did you want to have? What were you expecting? I don't know. Something's supposed to happen. I contemplated impermanence. Something's supposed to happen. It's like, well, that thought that something is supposed to happen is also impermanent. That desire to want something, you dig deeper. Sometimes we have a preconceived idea of what we're supposed to be getting. I think it's supposed to be a blast of light or some sort of incredible vision of the Buddha. So just the contemplative mind, though, is just to remain very open and receptive, still putting effort into the meditation object and into the various contemplations, such as the contemplation of the body, but also being very open to what the results of that might be. So the Buddha and the teachers tell us brightness, coolness, etc. but we don't really know that for ourselves. So it's just experiencing it and saying it is like this. I don't have to say it is this or it is that. Sometimes it can be difficult. The hindrances get really strong. I feel cornered, like in the imagery of being in the boxing ring with Mara and just getting hammered. Feeling like we, because the mind is very difficult to train and it goes up and down so much, it's easy to get into that state of feeling like, what is it? What is it all for? Like, there's this chant with the Brahma Viharas, I will abide. Pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. In early days here, one of the monks modified it to say, abandoned, exhausted, and miserable. Because that's the feeling. I felt that too in the first couple of years as a monk, sometimes it would be like, I'd have the work period in the morning, and then after the meal, because you get up at, I'd get up at 3 or 4 in the morning, and after the meal feel just exhausted, but then pushing through and walking meditation and practice, and coming down, tea time, and maybe there's some other work, like something's wrong with the computer, helping one of the senior monks fix that, and feeling like, if I was a layperson, I could just walk, I could just do my job and then get off work at 5 p.m. and crack open a beer and watch a movie, and things would be so much better. So I just remember thinking that. I'm glad I didn't follow that impulse, actually. I'm glad I didn't follow it. Haven't had that thought for a while. Other hindrances can come up. And sometimes, like you get questions like, how do I cultivate humility, or how do I learn how to be more humble? Like, those are ideals of a contemplative as well. It's like not being really egotistical or putting oneself up on a pedestal above others. And so you get that question sometimes. How do I be more humble? How do I develop humility? I was thinking about this today, and a lot of it, I think, comes from less like a conscious development of those things, but more it's a result of a recognition of the web of support that we have. Just the fact that, one, we even have a monastery like this here that we can practice in with this form of the winter retreat. So we might think, this is wrong with the monastery, or that's wrong with the monastery. It could be improved in this way or that way. But just the fact that it's here and it's enough to practice and contemplate, that's one thing. and the web of interconnectedness that just brought this place about, stemming from the Buddha and Tenajin Mun, Tenajin Cha, Lungpur Sumedho, Lungpur Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, everything that's helped this place come to be, also the support from the lay people over the years. It's allowed it to persist and remain here. All of the members of the community here who have helped to build the monastery. It's an incredible amount of work to have these facilities to make it comfortable and convenient to cultivate and to practice. And it's not something that I did or any one person did, so it's very humbling. Especially the support from the lay people. That really struck me when I was living at Pujamgam, a much smaller community, so usually there was only two or three of us, sometimes four or five, maybe. But receiving the support from the lay people in a much more direct way than here, as far as it's much more apparent in a smaller community that what you're receiving is sustaining your life. My very life is sustained through the gifts of others. That becomes very, very clear on Tudong as well, whether it's in Thailand or in the West. So my very life is sustained through the gifts of others. So the kindness we've received from others is humbling. The very fact that we're able to practice, we don't live in a time of war. It's a very small window in the big scheme of things. The fact that the Dhamma is here being taught in a language that we understand. The fact that we've been born during this time in the big scheme of things, extremely small window of history where the Buddha's teaching is available, still exists in the world. Been born with all of our faculties, intellect. We're able to contemplate, follow, and understand the Dhamma. So this is a huge impersonal web here. It's not, I'm able to practice because of my special qualities, because of me, because of something I have that allows me to do all of this for myself. It's very humbling to think of just the great web of interconnectedness that brings these things about. And we're just one little tiny part of that web. In the end, of course, we have to practice for ourselves, but just the ability to be able to practice and even the intention to want to practice has come about through the efforts of others. If my life was perfect before I came to the monastery, I wouldn't have wanted to practice. So I can even be grateful for obstacles and adversities met with before ordaining, because they had the good result of being able to ordain, causing me to have a weariness for the world and wanting to practice and understand the Dhamma. So there's this nibbida, just world weariness or disenchantment. It's not to be confused with aversion. It's something very different. We're not averse to the world or trying to destroy or annihilate something. But Nibbida is a, maybe you could think of as a sobriety. So what we're addressing here is addiction, craving, tanha. Addiction. I remember one of my friends from lay life, I was talking to him on the phone one day after I'd been here for a few years, and he's asking about what the practice is, how do we practice, why do we practice, what are we practicing? And I was talking about meditation and precepts, refraining from all sorts of things. His question, he had a good question, was, well, can't you just get addicted to meditation? Thinking about that, yeah, of course, you can get addicted to anything. But tanha, addiction, that's the, we're trying to use wisdom to strike at the root of addiction. And so our mental states, moods, can be addicted to different mental states. We can be so addicted to a mental state that it's actually more addictive than any drug, depending on the temperament of each individual. These mental states can be more addictive than heroin. We can have a persistent mental state, like, for example, sadness or aversion. You can actually be addicted to that mental state. That's why it comes up over and over and over again. Or it's like in the suttas, like these self-mortifying ascetics, they pluck their hair out and are addicted to this practice. They smear excrement all over their bodies and they are addicted to that practice, unable to let it go. They beat themselves with thorns and are addicted to that practice. They scorn society and go away when told to come and come when told to go away. And they are addicted to this practice. So we can be addicted to the most ridiculous things, but it's addiction, it's tanha. So taking a look, contemplating, seeing, what are we actually addicted to? Or some people of a certain temperament might be quite happy a lot of the time, happy-go-lucky. That's good as well. That can be used to one's advantage. But one has to be careful of, if that changes, there can be sadness there. Just knowing that all these things change. And sometimes nothing much seems to be happening. So we're on the boat, we're in the doldrums, there's no wind at all. Boredom. Lungpo Cha would say, sometimes after you've been a monk for 5 years, you reach a state which we call bua, which is bored. So, okay, well, you know, not suffering so much, just kind of bored, just nothing to do. So that's a danger. That's the doldrums. That's, you have to be careful of that. Have to develop patient endurance and also kind of ardency or unremitting zeal, which pulls one through those times of boredom and getting stuck in a rut. So it's a long journey. How long have we not trained ourselves? And we don't have to look at past lives, which are hidden, obscured by rebirth, so we can't see past lives. Most people can't see their past lives, but even just this life, how long have we not trained ourselves in this life? I know for myself, I mean, as a young person and in high school, when I reflect back now, my mind was tending towards an evil nature, evil-minded nature, not wholesome, not good. And when I saw that, there was a sense of urgency. It's one of the reasons I came to the monastery at a young age. So yeah, the mind is habitually going in that direction. I don't want it to go in that direction. I can see that it was going to be great suffering in life. So we see a problem, we do have to solve it. If the mind is turning dark or unwholesome, if you use the contemplations, using the Satipatthana, using the teachings to brighten the mind, or at least bring it to equilibrium. Because things develop slowly, I got the advice from a Thai monk once. Because I've been a monk for 2 or 3 years, I was pretty sure I would disrobe after 5. And he just gave me the advice, well, when you reach 5, just look back, and if your mind is better and more well-trained than when you ordained, then you can stay on. And if it's worse off, then yeah, go ahead and disrobe. So I took that advice, and of course the mind was much better after 5 vasas than it was when I ordained. And then taking everything in 5-year increments, because things change imperceptibly. It could seem like one isn't doing so well, and actually there's developments happening. So we have to see the way things are and use everything, learn from it. If there's anger, we can learn from it. If there's greed, we can learn from it. Actually, the defilements can come to teach us. If there's suffering, we can learn from it. On a certain level, dukkha is better than sukha, because if there's happiness or bliss, then rather than wanting to learn from it, we just want to be absorbed into it. So even happiness or bliss or samadhi, taking it, learning from it. If it's conditioned, you'll learn from it. The condition is like this, it's impermanent. Not ultimately satisfying, not self. You know, how could it last? So we, normally the way everyone lives their lives is to have some sort of edifice or foundation built up in order to have these precarious, extremely precarious sense of happiness or well-being. So build up and try to keep in place a house of cards which keeps dukkha at least at a bearable distance. But if it doesn't come collapsing down now, then it'll come collapsing down when old age comes, when death comes. Everybody has to pass away. Everybody has to die. So not only is happiness and sadness impermanent, the physical world, the body is impermanent. body is not self. So learning how to contemplate these things all the time. Body is impermanent, feelings are impermanent. Sila is impermanent, samadhi is impermanent, panya is impermanent. So we're developing sila, samadhi, panya, but our sila is something we have to cultivate and perfect. We have to be careful. So we put great effort into cultivating sila, but it can degenerate. If it degenerates, it's difficult to build it up again. Not that it can't be done. It's just not easy. If samadhi degenerates, difficult to build it back up again. You know, wisdom can degenerate. We have to protect and guard these things, even though they're conditioned. Sati, mindfulness. Mindfulness can degenerate. We have to look after it, nurture it. And mindfulness of skillful objects, mindfulness of the body, feelings. And then the mindfulness of the body has to be skillful. So using all of the contemplations and the Dhamma teachings to learn how to direct the mind in a skillful way. There's one sutta where a monk comes to the Buddha and asks, why do some monks here leave the training and return to the household life? And the Buddha responds, those monks give inappropriate attention to the sign of the beautiful. Therefore, they return to the household life. This is worthy of contemplation. We, as samanas, as cultivators, we give attention to the sign of the unbeautiful aspect of the body, unattractive nature of the body. Not as a morbid contemplation or morbid fascination with death and corpses, but as a cooling, sobering reflection, giving rise to that cool nibbida, you know, lessening the addiction, lessening tanha little by little. So we can rest, so we can swim. So we can bask in the sun, so we can be in the cool water. If the anger is strong, it's just burning the mind, it's hot. Lust, greed, strong, it's just, the mind is just on fire, it's not content. It's not just, you know, unsatisfactory isn't the right word, it's out and out suffering, it's torment, it's misery. The mind is on fire. Sometimes the Buddha spoke in very light terms. Sometimes he would say, you know, monk's form is unsatisfactory, feeling is unsatisfactory, perception is unsatisfactory, mental formations are unsatisfactory, consciousness is unsatisfactory. And then in the very next sutta, he'll say, monk's form is misery, feelings are misery, perception is misery, mental formations are misery, consciousness is misery. Consciousness is like a conjurer's trick. So reading a very interesting talk from Ajahn Mahabua a couple days ago, and he was talking about how his perceptions and mental formations changed and transformed at a certain point in his practice. He's very far along in his practice, and his mind already wasn't attaching to external objects or mental states anymore. It was just completely going inward. And he said that the whole world became like flitting shadows, like both the external world plus his thoughts were like flitting shadows, his perceptions were like flitting shadows, his feelings were like flitting shadows. So the five aggregates became like shadows coming in and out of existence. And why was that? It's because the mind wasn't clinging to them anymore. So I think that's very interesting, that it's a very interesting reflection on consciousness, that is the mind, or our experience of the six sense bases is like a conjurer's trick. But for Tenrajan Mahabua, when his mind was going completely inward, then that conjurer's trick was more like a flitting shadow. It was seen through, seen clearly. The clinging is so strong, we actually don't realize it. It's actually making the conjurer's trick look real. Contact. So the eye contacting forms, ear contacting sounds, and so on. It's like the Buddha gave the analogy. It's like a flayed cow being exposed to the elements. And then with the transcending of contact, then that sort of intense exposure to the outside world ends. But because we have it all the time, we don't see it. Because our experience is like that of a flayed cow all the time. Don't know anything different. We can't imagine what it would be like to not have that. Or like the Lungpur Ban reading the other day, how can the unpeaceful mind know the unpeaceful mind? We just have to rely on time, listening to many Dhamma teachings, studying, discussing Dhamma, working through it, being patient. And then when things calm down, allowing ourselves to swim in that temporary peace and clarity that we've attained, so then temporarily the peaceful mind can contemplate the unpeaceful mind. If the mind is temporarily peaceful, if we attain a measure of samadhi through our practice, cultivation, the vajji sankhara, the verbal formation, starts to quiet down a bit. The mindfulness gets stronger. Yeah, we start to see with more clarity. I think I'll just leave it there for this evening. A few thoughts. Andamayam dhamma kataya sadhu karam dhamma se sadhu.